Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Marwa El-Zenkali. I am counsel for the appellant Rahina Ibrahim. This marks our second time here before this court on this matter. Our case was dismissed against the federal government a few years ago, and we were before this court, I believe, back in 2008. Our case was dismissed on the grounds that the district court had no jurisdiction against the federal government. This court overturned that decision and found that the district court did have jurisdiction against most of the federal agencies that were named as defendants in the case, with the exception of the TSA. I think it's really important to have a good understanding of, at least based on what we've submitted and what we've been able to piece together so far, of how the several agencies work together and how that work has affected Ms. Ibrahim. And from the evidence in the record, the Terrorist Screening Center, the TSC, is the main agency that basically is responsible for compiling names of individuals who are either suspected or known or identified as potential terrorists. And what the TSC does is it maintains a database called the Terrorist Screening Database, and it funnels that information to various local, state, and federal agencies, including the TSA, but not limited to the TSA, also the what the federal government has identified as its class system, which is part of the State Department. It also funnels that information to various foreign governments. And if you are identified on the TSDB, the Terrorist Screening Database, you not only might not be able to fly, but it also might affect you in other ways. In my client's case, with respect to the revocation of her visa, it might affect your ability to fly within the United States, but it also can affect your ability to fly outside of the United States, as we've seen from the federal government's own website, which basically says that if you are identified on the no-fly list, it will affect your ability to fly all over the world.
Mm-hmm. That is to say, a U.S. carrier will not...
And potentially not a U.S. carrier as well. And that's information that we're trying to piece together. But from the information that we've submitted, it basically says that the names that are on the list can be given to foreign governments, and that it affects a person's ability to fly all over the world. It doesn't specifically say U.S. carriers. In my client's situation, we submitted a declaration from my client that said that basically while she was in an airport in Kuala Lumpur, she was told that there is a note next to her name saying to arrest her. And this is all outside of the United States. Now,
could I just ask a question that bothered me in reading the briefs? The government seems to be citing the cases which the alien has never been in the United States. You cite the cases in which the alien is the claimed offense is while the alien is still in the United States. Do you have any cases that reconcile these two lines?
I think that in doing our research, we have not been able to find a case that is exactly on point, that is very similar to our situation. However, I think with respect to our case, we believe our case is more similar to the cases that we've cited because the courts usually, from what we've seen, look at where the harm occurred that gave rise to the constitutional violation. What the court did, the district court did, and what counsel for the federal government argues is that they're really looking at the remedy involved and basically stated that because the remedy is seeking prospective relief, that therefore that's what you look at in determining whether she has constitutional rights and its extraterritorial application of her constitutional rights. What we're arguing is that the constitutional violation occurred while she was in the United States during a time that she was legally and lawfully in the United States, had substantial connections in the United States, and that's where the violation occurred, and therefore she should be able to remedy that violation, which is an ongoing harm that continues to occur.
So you're arguing it's just really one ongoing violation. Is that your argument?
Correct. And it started
in the United States.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
And how... When you say the violation occurred in the United States and is ongoing, what are you characterizing as the violation? Putting her on the list, preventing her from flying? I mean, what do we encompass within that term, violation, as you want to use that term?
Or is it the denial of the visa?
So it's the placement of her name on what she believes is the terrorist screening database. Her claim against the federal government is a claim that she filed under the Administrative Procedures Act, which includes both constitutional and non-constitutional violations. But basically, it is she is seeking to remove her name from the terrorist screening database, and the violation, the specific violation, is the placement of her name on that database. Now,
but she was told that her list, she was removed from the list. And what happens? They have her on the list. She said, "Take me off." They said, "We took you off. Here is your, you can fly to Malaysia." And then what if they put her on after she has left the United States?
So our belief is that, and also keep in mind that this is on a motion to dismiss, which is based on the face of the pleadings. And what we've pled based on her belief is that she was never removed. She was told that she was removed, but the federal government has never confirmed or denied that she is or is not on the list. What she was allowed to fly to Malaysia, but having gone through enhanced security screening, even though she was allowed to fly, which indicates that her name wasn't necessarily removed. And once she got to Malaysia,
her motive dress, it could have been any of the factors that they consider when they put you aside. I travel with my clerks, and I'm usually the one asked to be investigated when we get on the airplane, and I never quite know why. So there could be many reasons why she is removed, other than the fact that she had not been removed from the list.
I think for us, we're working on what little information we have been able to gather and what it implies. And the federal government has provided the court with nothing in response, at least no substantive information in response that indicates when she was placed or how she was placed. They've refused to even acknowledge that she was placed or is not on the list. And so in a motion to dismiss, my understanding is generally you apply the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And, you know, she was able to come into the United States in September 2001 lawfully, legally, without any problems. So presumably she was not on any kind of a list. When she tried to fly out in 2005, that's when the problems occurred. So presumably it happened, at least initially, while she was in the United States. Now what happened after that, no one knows. Right, because they've submitted nothing to indicate either way, and all we've been able to do is piece together what's happened, which is after she flew out of the United States, again under enhanced security screening, which is beyond the typical, you know, you have to go through a metal detector or what have you, and came into Malaysia, and she was there temporarily for a conference and was coming back to complete her PhD, came into Malaysia, and suddenly her visa was revoked by the U.S. Embassy, citing to a section of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which basically says that a U.S. Embassy can revoke your visa or deny a visa for someone that they believe is engaged in terrorist activities. So there appears to be a clear connection, and it's affecting her in different ways. So her ability to fly, revocation of her visa, and at this point she doesn't know what else.
I'm reading paragraph 45. Of your client's complaint, and I'm just reading. Defendants represented the plaintiff that her name had been removed from the no-fly list. The following day, January 3rd, 2005, Ibrahim discovered that she was still on the no-fly list when she attempted to fly again. After some effort, Ibrahim finally was finally allowed to fly. That is, as I read that, they told her at one point, your name is off the list. Then they tell her the name is on the list, at which point she is nonetheless allowed to fly. So the last piece of information she gets before she leaves the United States, at least according to your complaint, is she's still on that list.
Correct. Right.
Yeah, so her information is that when she left the United States, her name was on the no-fly list rather than it had been removed. She was told for a moment that it was off the list,
right.
But at the time she left, she'd been told that it was on the list.
It was still on the list.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah, and also keep in mind, she's talking to various agents, some local, some federal, and you know, the information that she's getting is, you know, again, it has never been officially confirmed or denied. by the federal government or its counsel.
So what, if we were to rule for you at this stage, what would our order to the district court be?
That the case be remanded back to the district court and allow the plaintiff to proceed on her Administrative Procedures Act claim against the federal government, finding that she can make a constitutional claim based on the placement of her name on the no-fly list. And alternatively, what we're also asking is if the court finds that she does not have constitutional rights, that she still be able to proceed with her APA claim, which is not necessarily based on a constitutional violation, because under the Administrative Procedures Act, you can challenge agency action without necessarily...
Under the arbitrary and capricious standard, yes. So the only thing you're asking us to say is that you have the right to proceed with the claim, and what's in front of us is not the substance of the claim, not whether there's been a violation of due process or what the actual remedy would be. That's not in front of us at this time.
That's correct, Your Honor. In the number of years that we've had this case pending, we're still sort of at the pleading stage where our case again was dismissed on a motion to dismiss.
Well, you're looking for something, right? How is the district judge to handle a case if he gets it and you say, well, we're not sure what we're looking for? You're looking for something, and the something you're looking for is reinstatement of her right to come and go as she pleases in the United States. Is that correct?
Well, that her name be removed from the terrorist screening database, or that she basically get a fairness hearing over the placement of her name on the database, so that she's able to contest
Does everybody get a fairness hearing about whether or not they get their name placed on a terrorist list?
Currently, we don't believe so, and that is okay. Considered to be a flaw in the process.
Does a person outside the United States have a right to say whether or not they're going to get the right to come into the United States? Do they have a constitutional right to bring a claim in the United States? She's outside. There's no two ways about that. And constitutional right to say, give me a visa or give me the reason why you're not giving me a visa.
A person who is outside of the United States, who has never come into the United States, does not have a constitutional right to demand a visa.
So the fact that she was in here once gives her that right?
She was in here for 4 years studying at Stanford.
Maybe, but she was in here once.
And right? I think it's also important to note that her request is not to be given a visa, because that's actually not within the jurisdiction of the district court. Her request is that her name be removed from
so
the
So, in other words, the district court couldn't give her the visa, and therefore she wouldn't get what she was looking for.
She could, because we believe that the reason her visa was revoked is because of the placement of her name on the terrorist screening database. So what we've requested in her complaint is that not only she be given, her name be taken off, or that she be given a fairness hearing, but if her name is taken off, that information be funneled to the federal agencies or other agencies that have been given her name in the first place. So the ultimate effect of that is up to that agency, of course.
Yeah, but look, if she name remains on the no-fly list, she can take a Malaysian flight to Vancouver. Agree?
Possibly not.
Well, possibly not, but you don't have any facts to back that up, and you have to plead facts in your... In your complaint, so
we actually submitted an article where
did you plead facts saying that she applied for a flight on Malaysian Airlines to Vancouver and was turned down?
No, she has not actually tried to fly to Vancouver and was turned down.
All right, so you're suggesting suppositions that she wouldn't get to Vancouver, but if she could get to Vancouver by boat or by some other way. She could then drive across, according to you, if she had a visa, but she doesn't have a visa.
Right. Her visa was revoked.
Okay. Now, so the real thing that you're looking for is a visa.
We're looking for the removal of her name from the database, because the removal, her name in the database does not just affect her ability to get a visa. According to the government's own website, it will affect her ability to fly all over the world. And
that's true, but
But the U.S. government can't order the Malaysian Airlines not to fly somebody someplace.
But they can provide them with information to tell them to not fly somewhere, someplace.
Sure.
Now, what the Malaysian government does with it, that's the Malaysian government's, you know, decision. However, if the U.S. government is providing another foreign government with information about an individual, that is false, or it can affect that individual's ability to fly outside of the United States.
I hate to tell you, but I think that happens, you know. We have suspicion that, is all the State Department has to say. And you're suggesting that somebody can then bring a lawsuit saying, oh, you told such and such, you know, a nation what your suspicions are. You can't do that. I don't think it goes quite that far. And I don't think that any court would have the right to interfere in foreign relations that way.
And we're actually not asking the court to interfere with foreign relations. We're asking the court to look at the placement of her name in the TSDB, which is something that's done by a federal agency of the United States, which the district court would have jurisdiction to be able to do.
Yeah, I understand, but all right, go ahead.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if the court has no further questions.
It's fine, sure.
Okay, thank you.
So you've reserved three minutes and 40 seconds.
I'm sorry?
3 minutes and 40 seconds.
Okay. May it please the court, my name is Joshua Waldman. I'm here from the Department of Justice, representing the appellees in this case. The plaintiff in this case is a citizen of Malaysia who lives in Malaysia. She's an alien. She's not a U.S. citizen. She is not currently in the United States, nor was she in the United States at the time she filed her claim. She seeks only prospective relief, and she has no substantial connections with this nation.
Well, that last one is the only one that's debatable of what you just said.
I agree that there's at least debatable. If you want me to move right to that, I will. The only allegations about substantial connections the plaintiff makes is essentially personal connections with people that she met at Stanford while she was here doing her studies. We are aware of not a single case from any court that we could find where that kind of relationship, personal relationship.
Well, but you're narrowing. I mean, the story is as follows, and I don't think these facts are in dispute. And, of course, we're 12B6. She was a graduate student studying for a PhD in engineering with a focus on affordable housing. She'd been a graduate PhD student for 4 years at Stanford. She attempts to leave the country to go to a conference in her capacity as a Stanford PhD student. Then the episode at the airport occurs. She's finally allowed to fly. She is never allowed to come back into the country. She submits her thesis remotely, as it were, and so on, and has never come back again. But I think it narrows it quite a bit just to say, well, she's got some friends here, and that's the only substantial connection.
Well, it's certainly not just friends. I mean, she has academic relationships with people. That's for sure, and that's at least the allegations in the complaint, and we have to accept this is true because we're on 12B6. But as far as we're aware, the only cases that have ever said, they ever relied on substantial connections as opposed to actual physical presence, are cases involving actual property rights in which the constitutional claim was itself about the deprivation of those very same connections that gave you a constitutional right. Here we have no property rights that we're talking about, no allegations of any property rights, and the constitutional.
Is the definition of property here an issue? You keep saying property rights.
I'm saying that because the cases that rely only on substantial connections as opposed to actual physical presence of an alien only deal with property rights. So there's
yes, but all of the cases that you cited, if I'm not mistaken, dealt with people who were outside the United States. If we said that the violation occurred while she was in the United States, doesn't that distinguish her case?
If that were the injury, but she's asking for injunctive relief, which requires her to show the threat of a future injury, not a past injury. And remember, she has previously sued the United States seeking backward-looking relief for what happened to her in 2005.
But isn't she also seeking the right to have a visa? And this is dependent on the decision as to whether or not it was appropriate for her to be put on the no-fly list.
Well, she would still be seeking a future-looking order saying, give me a visa in the future.
No, she's not. She's very clearly said she's not seeking a visa. She'd like to get one, but she's not seeking it from us.
I thought you were posing that might be a claim that she might make. And if that were the case, which we don't think it is, and it would be barred under the consular non-reviewability doctrine anyway, it would still be a future-looking claim. And I think that's an important distinction to make because it's the one that Judge Alsop relied on below, which is to say, if what you're looking for is future-looking relief to address an injury that will occur in the future when the alien is not present in the United States, they do not have a – it's – you're asking for relief for an injury at a time when you have no basis on which to stake your constitutional claims.
Let me just see if I understand what you're saying. Do you have any case at all that says that an alien cannot assert a constitutional claim for a continuing violation that begins when the alien is in this country?
Well, it's not quite clear. What we have are the D.C. Circuit cases that deal with future relief for an alien who's not present in the United States. And it's not clear. Those are terrorist designation cases. It's not clear when those designations are made, when the exact actual decision is. But what I would say is if you have an – if you're asking for relief for an injury that occurred when you were present, in other words, a past injury – when you were present, that Judge Alsop's opinion leaves that possibility open, that you could get damages or backward-looking relief for that. Right. But if you're looking for prospective relief for an injury that would occur in the future when you are not present, Judge Alsop said at that point, your lack of presence and lack of connections in the future precludes the alien non-citizen from asserting constitutional claims for that form of relief. And remember, in this case, there were constitutional claims against the San Francisco co-defendants for the actions in 2005, her alleged detention. And they were constitutional claims under Section 1983, as well as state law claims. And there was a settlement of that. I don't think San Francisco said that they couldn't bring constitutional claims. And they brought constitutional claims against us, the federal government, under 1983, also seeking past damages. Those claims were dismissed. So her damages claims for past events are not before this Court at this time. So we're only talking about future relief for alleged future injuries when she will not be here.
Yeah. What do you do with the Quang Hai Chu case?
I'm not sure I remember exactly the title. Is that the one who came here to testify?
No. It's decided by the United States Supreme Court in 1953. He's an alien who is on a ship and would like to come back into the United States. He's detained, excluded at Ellis Island, and he's an alien, and the court says you're allowed to bring this claim.
Well, I'm not exactly familiar with that case, I'll be honest with you, but what I imagine is at that time you might have been deemed present by landing at Ellis Island for some purpose. I don't know.
No, the rule is, you know, if you're being excluded for purposes of a claim, you're still excluded.
Right.
He was challenging his exclusion.
All I know is what the Supreme Court says in cases like Archidas, where it says the key to an alien non-citizen who wants to assert constitutional claims is their physical presence or the substantial connection to the country. So I honestly don't know the facts of that case.
The case was cited in the blue brief, but I guess you didn't read it.
Well, I don't remember it. Maybe I read it at the time, but I just honestly I don't remember.
Okay, no, that's a fair answer. Sure.
But I think before the court even needs to get to this question, it could also decide the entire case simply on standing grounds. And we have primarily two arguments. The first is that the injury claimed here is essentially the inability to return to the United States. And we think, regardless of any order about the no-fly list, The plaintiff cannot return to the United States simply because she has no valid visa.
You know, you added the word essentially as if there's parts of her claim you're not going to pay any attention to for purposes of standing.
No, I'm just going to get – I would get to those later or if you ask me a question about it, but I want to talk about it in the main and get into sort of some – a little bit more into the weeds after that. Would you like me to proceed right to that now?
Look, here's the standing argument from her perspective, as I understand it, and as Judge Alsup held. I mean, you lost on that point in front of Judge Alsup.
Yes.
That she says if my name is taken off this list, I will be able to fly unimpeded on U.S. carriers abroad. Whatever obstacles might exist on flying on non-U.S. carriers, those would also be gone, although I don't think she's specifically relying on that for purposes of standing. And it's possible that other good things might happen.
Okay. Let me address
why is that not enough?
Okay. There's a couple answers, and let me start with the first one, which is about, well, maybe there's foreign port A to foreign port B where I don't have to come into the United States and I don't need a visa, maybe I'd be injured there. If you look at the declaration that she relies on and Judge Alsup relied on to show standing, there is not one allegation in that declaration or anything in the complaint that talks about an injury by being unable to fly, for example, from Malaysia to Tokyo. There are simply no allegations about any kind of credible threat from the no-fly list affecting that.
Isn't it true that if you're on the no-fly list, a U.S. carrier will not carry you?
A U.S. carrier, yeah. There may be non-U.S. carriers that could carry you, but not U.S. carriers. Right. It's true, but there's been no – she's known that, and we've said that since this case, but there's no allegation of that. And as Judge Duffy said, you have to plead facts in these cases, and she's never once pled that that's her injury.
Yeah. Now, Judge Alsup's response in part was, well, I understand there's this visa problem, but for purposes of standing, I'm not going to require her to tackle all of the obstacles at once. Right. And I'm now reading a little bit between the lines of what Judge Alsup wrote, but I don't think very far between the lines. If she's removed from the no-fly list, it's actually fairly likely, or I should say removed from the suspect list, the one that produces then the no-fly list, it's very likely that, in fact, she'll get the visa. I mean, that seems to be the obstacle.
Okay, let me address
that. We have no power to order that she be given it. I understand that.
Sure. Let me address that in two parts. First is just on the face of the opinion where he says she doesn't have to remove all obstacles at once. Yeah. Just on the face of that, without reading between the lines, I think that's an incorrect statement. And, you know, with all due respect for Judge Alsup, who I think is a great and smart judge, I think the essence of redressability is you have to be able to undo your injury as a result of the relief.
You don't have to. It has to have a reasonable chance of something.
Well, there's no chance that she's going to come back to the United States without a visa. We all know that. Right. I mean, that's indisputable. So then if you read between the lines, the question is sort of, what is it going to affect other decisions?
Is it likely to?
Right. I think what you need to understand is the difference between the State Department's relationship to the TSDB, the Terrorist Screening Database, and the no-fly list relationship, because they're completely different things. First of all, they're obviously made by different decision makers. State makes the visa determination. TSC makes the no-fly list determination.
Right.
Second, the no-fly list, when it gets sent out to TSA from TSC, is a decision that's already been made. Someone is on the no-fly list, they're not, and then it's given to TSA. The State Department essentially gets information from the TSDB. What happens is the state gets a visa application, and they say, administering the TSDB, is this person on the database? And if the answer is yes, they don't get an answer, deny the visa or not. They get information.
Right.
The very same information that before the TSDB existed, they would just walk around.
But I'm not sure we need to do all this detail, because I think the point I made that I think Judge Alsup had in mind is still there. That is to say, of course it's a different decision maker. The question is, what is the State Department likely to do as soon as she is no longer on this list?
I think it's entirely speculation and conjecture.
I mean, is there any reason except for the fact that she's on this list?
She sued
the United States government?
That's
the implication.
She sued the United States government, that's why she...
That's the implication of some of the questions she was asked in her visa interview. What's the state of this year's lawsuit here that you got against the United States? Are you going to settle this lawsuit?
Well, she had already, you know, she had already had her visa revoked by that point.
I understand.
If you look at the statutory citation in the letter denying her visa application, it's, the actual cite is 8 U.S.C. 1182A3B. And if you look at that, there's about a dozen different reasons why someone might have their visa denied, one of which I think is called something like engaging in terrorist activity. And if you read the next subsection down, there's about a dozen definitions of what that might mean. So there's about two dozen different reasons, which are really quite broad, about why someone might be denied under that specific statutory section. So I think it's just absolute conjecture to say, because, you know, if we were to sort of take her off the no-fly list, and then if we were to do the further step of sort of reviewing the intelligence.
I'm using a shorthand that you're not picking up.
Okay.
Take her off the TSCB list.
If you take her off the TSCB. Oh, I think.
Because that's what they're after. Right. I mean, and that has consequences, of course, for the no-fly list.
Right.
But they're asking that she be taken off the TSCB list.
Now, I mean, the odd thing about that is all the TSDB really is a warehouse for information that always existed. And before the TSDB existed as a warehouse of information, state would just go around to various government agencies asking for information about people. Now they don't have to do that sort of multiple stops. They just do one stop. And then they still get the information, and then they make their decision.
Here's the basic problem in the case. She contends this is all a colossal mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that it is all a colossal mistake. I don't know. The government's position is you cannot make us fix a colossal mistake.
Well,
it may or may not be one, and we're not going to inquire, and you have no ability to bring any lawsuit to force us to inquire.
Well,
I mean, that's the position.
Well, let me just sort of break that out. With respect to the visa, absolutely. We say there's no suit that you can bring to make us change.
Yeah, the visa she's not asking for.
With respect to the no-fly list, there is a redress procedure, and she has submitted to that redress procedure, and it's been 5 years since she attempted to fly to the U.S. since there. This is sort of, if there's a standing problem of not being able to bring the suit, it's one of sort of her own creation.
Wait a minute. She got an answer which struck me as profoundly ambiguous. I mean, the redress procedure, they didn't say we have resolved it and we made a mistake, or we've resolved it and we think you belong there. They gave her some gobbledygook answer that I could not understand.
The reason why the answer is ambiguous, for sure, and the reason why we do that is the same reason that we don't tell people at the onset if you just ask if you're on the no-fly list, because for obvious security reasons, you don't disclose who's on the no-fly list and who's not.
Well, except they did to her. They said you're on the no-fly list and you can't fly.
Well, no. What happened is an airline employee told her that she was on the no-fly list, not the TSA. And if you actually read Exhibit C to her own supplemental request for judicial notice, you'll see a sort of a Q&A from TSA that says, you know, if an airline employee tells you you're on the no-fly list, the TSDB, does that mean you're actually on it? And the answer is no.
Could I just clarify what you have just said?
Yes.
Assuming there has been a colossal mistake,
mm-hmm.
Are you saying there is absolutely no remedy?
No, absolutely not. First of all, you can file a redress papers petition, which is specifically targeted for people who are either misidentified for someone who is on the list or for someone who thinks that they're mistakenly on the list.
You just said for people who are here.
Oh, no, it doesn't. We didn't say that because she was in Malaysia she couldn't file the redress petition. It's not a constitutional right to do it, but it's a redress proceeding that TSA affords people, including people outside the United States.
Does she have redress under the APA?
We're not making any argument that she can't bring an APA claim.
Yes, you are. You've said she's waived it.
Well, not as a statutory matter, as a matter of forfeiture. In this case, not that generally it's unavailable to aliens. I'm sorry.
I disagree that she's waived it, but you said she's waived it.
Yeah, we think in this case she's waived it. She's forfeited, to be a little bit more precise. But we're not making an argument that as a general matter, aliens outside the U.S.
can't
bring an APA claim.
Does that mean then if we disagree with you with respect to the APA claim and we say she has not waived it or forfeited, you concede that she can bring that claim?
We're not conceding it. We're just saying we're not making an argument at this point other than the forfeiture one.
But I thought you just answered Judge Nelson when she said, well, is there any possible redress? You said, well, she could bring an APA claim.
No, no, no. What I said is she could bring a redress petition under the TSA's own procedures.
And then you said she could file something under the APA.
Well, we're not making – I want to be clear about this. We're not conceding as a position in the United States that you could definitely bring an APA claim for this type of action. What we're saying is we're not asserting that argument right now. The only argument that we're making right now – and that's because we didn't raise any arguments like this in the district court. So the only arguments that we're making are ones about forfeiture. And the reason we're making that is the alleged APA non-constitutional aspects of this claim, I think it's important to understand how they came up in the context of this case and why that leads to forfeiture. Originally, as filed in the complaint, there was nothing about the APA. The APA wasn't cited. There was no reference to arbitrary or capricious. I mean, it was just all about constitutional claims, as well as a lot about co-defendants. And on the first appeal, we said that we didn't think that there were APA claims, and the court held because the allegations were unlawful conduct and a request for an injunction against the government, that was tantamount to an APA claim. And we took that as the APA is serving as a waiver of sovereign immunity and a cause of action to bring her constitutional claims, which were the only APA-type claims that the court mentioned the first time around. So when we went back and we litigated this case, we focused on constitutional claim because that, to us, is what appeared to be her claims against the United States. And but we got all the claims, the only claim against the federal government, dismissed on that ground. Now, if the plaintiff thought, hey, everybody, including Judge Alsop, have completely just forgotten about a bunch of claims, she had 8 months between the dismissal of all her claims against the federal government and a final judgment something.
The ordinary way you deal with a district judge having made a mistake is to appeal. She appealed. Right. So you can ask the judge for reconsideration. I understand that. But I don't think it's a waiver if you simply take your appeal.
May I answer your
question? Of course. Okay. You know, this is an important enough case. We'll talk as long as we need to hear the information, so don't be concerned. The same applies to you.
I appreciate that very much, Your Honor. I think that you're right in the normal course. But when you're asking, for example, if a district judge actually rules on something, you don't have to ask for reconsideration in order to appeal. But if the allegation is something the district judge did absolutely missed something that was evident to one side but not to the opposing counsel or even to the district judge, I think the normal course is you let the district judge know about that. Otherwise, you're a little bit sandbagging the judge to then go up on appeal and say...
But I understand that, and district judges quite understandably say, well, you know, I wish you'd brought that to my attention. But is that a waiver?
I think so. And I think it's analogous to a situation, for example, where a jury comes back with an excessive verdict and you want a remitter. Or throwing out the damages for one reason or another. You have to ask the district judge.
That was so far afield. Here's what happened. You moved to dismiss, mm-hmm. and you argued two grounds. Number one, insufficient connection, and therefore you can't bring anything. Mm-hmm. And that was sufficient to dismiss claim 13.
Right.
And then you said, and even if you get to the merits, the constitutional claims are lousy. You don't mention the APA.
That's right.
The response from their side responds to the argument you made. They didn't mention the APA either.
Right.
Judge also dismisses claim 13 without mentioning the APA.
Right.
But I don't see where there's a waiver.
Well,
if you'd made an argument that you should dismiss the APA claim, which is right there in mm-hmm. claim 13, and nobody says anything, they don't respond, that sounds like waiver to me. But you never made that argument.
Right.
They responded to all the arguments you made.
Right. But if the district judge then says, essentially, I'm dismissing the entire claim, which puts the plaintiff on notice that includes her non-constitutional claims, and 8 months go by, at any moment she could ask for reconsideration, I think it's incumbent on the plaintiff to go to the district court and say, I think you really missed something here. Otherwise, people...
I understand what you're saying in terms of courtesy to the district judge.
Right.
I understand what you're saying in terms of what might have been a good idea, but I don't think you've got any cases that say that constitutes a waiver.
Well, I think it's just failure to prosecute it below. Obviously.
We're dealing with 12b-6. You're talking about failure to prosecute?
Right. I think at this point, my only argument would be the adversarial system has to work properly. And this was an APA claim that we think was
– If it's to work properly and you want a dismissal of the APA claim in Rule 13, you should have argued it on that basis.
Well, I mean, from our point of view, we didn't read the complaint as asserting anything other than constitutional claims, given the nature of the way the APA came into the case in the first appeal. I think it's sort of incumbent on the plaintiff. I'll just leave it at that, Your Honor. If there are any further questions on the case, I'd be happy to address them.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
I just have a few quick points to make. I thought I heard counsel say that we didn't properly allege our APA claim outside of the constitutional violations. I just want to point the court to paragraph 127 in the excerpts of the record, page 0333, where we
go slow, all right? I'm old enough to think slowly, so. What was the record?
It's paragraph 127 of our complaint, which is at page number 0333 of our excerpts of the record.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And
that says, defendant's actions alleged in here were arbitrary, capricious, and abuse of discretion. That sounds like a classic APA non-constitutional claim. Yep.
The other one more thing I wanted to point out in the record, which is in our request for judicial notice that was submitted with our opening brief, was an article, Exhibit B to the request for judicial notice is an article entitled U.S. Authorities Divert Air France Flight Carrying No-Fly Journalist to Mexico. So in answer to your question, Your Honor, there is the possibility that a non-American flight can be affected by someone who is on the flight, who is on the no-fly list, who is not necessarily going to the United States. And I ask the court to look at the article that was submitted. The final thing I just wanted to point out is that counsel said that there is a whole host of reasons under the section that was cited under the U.S. Immigration and Nationality Act in denying Ms. Ibrahim's visa, that there's a whole bunch of reasons that are in that section. But the denial letter, which is Exhibit A to the request for judicial notice that we submitted with our opening brief, is very specific as to the reason and cites to Section 212A3B, which is the specific section that gives the reason of being suspected of engaging in terrorist activity. So those are the main things that I want to point out. And if the court has any further questions for me, I would submit.
Hang on a second. Give me that statutory section quotation again.
Sure. It's Section 212A3B.
Okay. Hang on a second. I think I've got it here, but I'm going to be slow. And the and what code chapter is it? I'm sorry.
I don't have the U.S. code section.
You know what? I'll find it later. Don't bother. Okay.
Okay. It's under INA 212.
USC. Yeah, there we go. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank both of you for very helpful arguments. Case of Ibrahim versus, who's the defense name? Napolitano, John Napolitano, Secretary of Homeland Security, is now submitted for decision.